All right, and if I start to go over, just cut me off so we don't run over. Okay, so I was asked to talk about mantle rheology, and so that's what I'm going to do because I'm generally obedient. So I thought I would start with some pretty basic stuff, like what is rheology? And essentially what we're dealing with is the flow of matter. If you start Googling rheology, you'll find all sorts of stuff in food science about like the shear deformation of cheese. And we're studying that, but with rocks, right? So we're really concerned with a couple of things, like what is the stress strain rate response? So can we make some kind of constitutive law to describe the flow of these materials? For me, because I am not a very good rheology person, I sort of just look at how strong things are. So I'm not quite this fancy. And then we can also look at things like what sort of microstructure or preferred orientation develops during deformation. And then just to give you an idea of, because I think conceptually it's a little bit weird to think about rocks flowing plastically. This is a marble that's been deformed in torsion, and it's a really dramatic example of sort of ductile deformation of something that, you know, when we pick it up and hold it, it seems like it should break, right, instead of flowing. Okay, so of course, why do we care about deformation in the deep earth? Well, the rheology of the mantle is going to control, well, and I guess the core is important too, right? But the rheology of the mantle is going to control things like the character of mantle convection, what happens to slabs as they're subducted into the Earth's deep interior. And of course, if you change the way that the mantle convects, you're going to change what sort of geochemical reservoirs and how well mixed things are. And since we're here to talk about heterogeneity, right, we want to know something about mixing. Okay, so do things like from the deep earth mix with the upper mantle. You know, I've got my cartoon here. But for example here, like the slab I've drawn in deflecting at the 660. So if you have a very, very stiff lower mantle, you might have a hard time getting slabs down there. Okay, so I was just going to start with some really simple stuff. So some constitutive models, so springs, dashpots, et cetera. I told Max last night that I was going to talk a little bit about macro rheology, and he told me that in geodynamics, this is just called rheology. So I thought I would first quickly define a couple things. So I'm sure you guys have talked about elasticity a little bit, and I'm going to focus mostly on plasticity. So if we're looking at elastic versus plastic, elastic is something that's a recoverable deformation. So on an atomic scale, you're taking atoms and you're perturbing them, and they stay there, right? Whereas if we do non-elastic, it's not recoverable deformation, so we're left with a deformed material, and this is really corresponding to atoms moving from one atomic site to another and staying there. Okay, so you know, just the most basic thing you can look at is linear elasticity, and I'm not going to talk more about this. I just sort of wanted to provide a framework. Where you can take a material and apply a stress to it, and it strains some amount, and that amount is governed by the elastic modulus. And this is a Young's modulus, this is a shear modulus. So if you have shear strain and shear stress, you use a shear modulus. And this is analogous to Hooke's law. If you have a spring, you pull it, the amount it stretches, right, just depends on your spring constant, okay? And if you plot your stress versus strain, right, your slope then gives you your elastic modulus. Okay, so I'm done with elasticity, pretty much. So if we now look at plastic mechanisms, right, we can have something where we have a linear viscous. So this is kind of the simplest case. This is a Newtonian viscosity. So we have a non-recoverable strain. We're gonna, if we apply a stress, right, the material is gonna deform, it's gonna change shape, but if we take that stress away, it's gonna stop deforming. Okay, but it's not going to go back to its original state. So you can't just relate your stress to a strain. You have to relate it to something else, and what we relate it to is strain rate. Okay, and so this is your normal deviatoric stress is related to your normal strain rate by 2 times your viscosity. Okay, and your sort of mechanical model is this dashpot where you pull it out, and it's a viscous, linear viscous dashpot. You could have a nonlinear viscous dashpot, but we won't do that. Okay. That's pretty simple. Now, one that's useful is a plastic model for when we're looking at rocks and crystals, okay? And this is like a sliding block, okay? So if you apply a stress that's below your coefficient of static friction, nothing moves, right? But if you pull harder, it'll start to slide. So the idea here is that below your yield stress, you don't get any strain. And when you reach that yielding, then your block starts to move. And you're not going to change your stress levels unless you accelerate your deformation. Okay, so you kind of have this yield strength sort of modulates what the maximum stress you can have is. Okay, so I'm not entirely done with elasticity because it turns out that an elastoplastic model is pretty good for crystals and rocks. Okay, and so this is just if you stick your spring on the sliding block. Okay, so your block doesn't move if you're below the yield stress, but you can stretch. And if you're below the yield stress, you take your stress away, you recover your strain. So you get this sort of elastic response initially. And then if you get to your yield stress, then you start to slide your block and you get a plastic response. Okay. And so lots of crystals look more or less like this. This is sort of a super idealized way of looking at it. Okay, I wanted to make a quick comment on this. I'm going to do this here rather than a little bit later, because you can see in these nice differential stress strain curves here that it looks pretty much like an elastic plastic model. Now, I'm not going to talk about brittle deformation really at all in this talk, and there's a good reason for that. It's that when you put things under higher confining pressure, that tends to suppress fracture. Okay, and this is how you can actually get ductile behavior at room temperature if your confining pressure is very high. These are some limestone deformation experiments from Patterson, 1958, moving to higher and higher confining stress. So this is like 100 MPa confining stress at room temperature, and you can see that you don't fracture the sample anymore. Okay, so because pressure and temperature both suppress brittle failure, we're not going to deal with it anymore. But just to make a point here that you can see this sort of nice elastic plastic behavior more or less.
Hey, Lowell.
Yeah.
So we have a question.
Yeah.
Can you go back?
Sure.
This is probably not something you want to talk about, but why? So, okay, in that plot at the top, we have strain and we have stress, I guess.
This is differential stress.
Differential stress, great.
Strain.
And so that first ramp is the elastic part,
yeah.
And then the kind of plateau is where we have the...
That's your yield stress.
Yeah.
And where you pick your yield stress is...
But then sometimes it keeps going up, and then sometimes it decreases. So what's going on there?
So I'm
going
to talk about that later, but this decrease where they drop is failure. That's fracturing.
Okay.
Okay. So when you crack it, you get a nice stress drop, and that's why they end these experiments early, because they just break. So your lowest confining stress, you can't get much past the elastic because everything just falls apart.
Okay.
Right. Now these that this is something called work hardening, and it's actually due to ductile processes. If you have a room temperature deformation, you tend to harden things. It's due to dislocation interaction. I'll talk about that in a little bit.
Thank you.
So you'll see this, and you can actually fit like a slope to that and try and figure out what your work hardening parameters are. That's probably not that important in the earth most of the time. Okay, so then for geodynamics types, you can have other constitutive models that maybe behave more like the earth as a whole, like the Maxwell model or Kelvin void. And if you want to get fancy, you start sticking these together and you get longer and longer diagrams. But these are useful for very, like the Maxwell, for example, gives you this sort of short time scale elastic response and a long time scale viscous response. So this is sort of a good model for, like, you know, if you propagate seismic waves through the earth, you see mostly elastic. But if you look at mantle convection over long time scales, you see something viscous, right? So you can come up with ways to do this. Okay. So I just kind of wanted to do that to give you an idea of kind of some sort of bigger picture rheology. But I wanted to go down onto the microscopic scale and talk about what's actually happening to crystals and rocks. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is diffusion and diffusion creep. This is eventually where I'm going with this. And so diffusion, right, was just governed by Fick's law, where you have the flux of atoms is related to a diffusion coefficient times a concentration gradient. Okay, and if you look around, like, typically you see some picture of like some balls in a beaker of water, right, and they're all on one side, and then they diffuse down your concentration gradient. And a crystal is a little more complicated, right, because you have bonding, you frequently have different kinds of atoms, and so this isn't quite right, but sort of conceptually it's good enough for us. You know, you can do this in three dimensions if you want. You can formulate it for a non-steady state diffusion, and then you can also do that in 3D, right? One thing I want to note about this And this is pretty common, is that all these equations assume that the diffusion coefficient is isotropic. Okay, and that's fine for a fluid. For a crystal, it's actually not the case. But generally speaking, you can kind of get away with that. It's most diffusion coefficients aren't super anisotropic. Okay, there's some examples. But in general, we're gonna work with an isotropic diffusion coefficient. Okay, so I just wanted to make a couple quick points about this. And I'm going to repeat these over and over, because I feel like if no one tells me things 10 times, I don't remember it. So the diffusion length scale, if you look at the diffusion coefficient, its units are meters squared per second, so it's essentially length squared over time. Okay, and so you can figure out sort of roughly like how far things can move in a given time. And if you look at minerals, so something at sort of a mantle temperature, you're looking at diffusion coefficients typically in the range of 10 to the minus 16, something like that. So it's pretty slow. But there's a large range. So if you look at something like hydrogen diffusion, it's maybe something like 10 to the minus 10. These are not exact numbers. These are, you know, they depend on temperature, lots of other things. But if you look at uranium thorium on the other end, it's maybe 10 to the minus 21. Okay. So my point here, hydrogen, which is unusually fast, can maybe move at high temperature a meter in 300 years. Which is just screaming fast for diffusion. But on the other hand, uranium thorium maybe moves 1 millimeter over the edge of the Earth, right? So this is why you can use systems like that to actually date anything, right? Because if it diffuses out too quickly, whatever you measure doesn't mean anything, okay? But my point here is, in general, diffusion length scales are small, okay? And it's a pretty inefficient way to homogenize. And so when we look at where diffusion is going to dominate during deformation versus other mechanisms, it's typically places where we can utilize a small length scale and temperature. Okay, so one point I want to make here, if we look at diffusion in crystals, okay, what we're actually dealing with here is sort of a probability of an atom to move from one site to another, okay? So it's just jumping from one atomic position to another. If you have a perfect crystal, there's nowhere really for it to go unless it switches positions with another atom, okay? And you can do it this way, or maybe you can run little circles, right? But it's really hard, because you have to have two atoms that decide to jump at the same place and in opposite directions, and it's just not very likely, okay? So diffusion is directly related to defect concentration, and fortunately for us, vacancies where you're missing an atom are pretty common in crystals, particularly at high temperatures. Okay, so if you look at this, the diffusion coefficient, it's really a probability to jump. It's got some length scale in here, and then this 1/6 is just a geometric number. And this probability of a jump is just related to your defect fraction and your probability to jump when a defect's present. Okay, so my point is you can't have a perfect crystal to do this. Okay, so if we start looking at defect fraction and jump probability, it turns out it has an Arrhenius type dependence on temperature. Okay, and so you typically see your diffusion coefficient written out something like this, where you have your diffusion coefficient is related to D naught, which is called the frequency factor, but it's just basically your baseline diffusion coefficient, right, times this exponential function that we've all seen. Someplace. So you've got an activation energy here, which is essentially the energy barrier you have to overcome to jump this atom to the next site. Okay. And if we were to look at this as an activation energy for a vacancy movement, right, it's just this energy hump. You have to get from this configuration to that configuration. And then you have this pressure and activation volume term. Okay, so this just takes into effect the effects of pressure. So, well, temperature tends to increase the number of vacancies, pressure tends to decrease it. And you can think about, right, if you're trying to decrease the volume of a crystal, having a hole in your crystal is not really what you want, right? So you tend to decrease vacancy concentrations with pressure. Okay, so your diffusion coefficient will go down. Okay, another way you can do that, because it's actually a little bit tricky to figure that out in the lab, especially at very, very high pressures. Experimentally, it's hard to measure diffusion coefficients at very high pressures and very high temperatures. So another way people do this is they scale it by something called homologous temperature scaling. And this is actually a really useful concept in just sort of understanding deformation behavior at large. And what you're doing is you're looking at the temperature of an experiment or the temperature of the mantle relative to the melting temperature of your material, right? And the idea here is that when you melt something, right, your atomic bonds are coming apart. You're losing your crystal structure. So if you look at different materials at different temperatures, say it's half of the melting temperature, they should sort of have the same kind of behavior, more or less. Okay, and the way this looks is you have your diffusion coefficient, which is a function of pressure and temperature, is equal to D naught times this exponential function with the homologous temperature scaling in there. Okay, this G is basically this function, but in practice it's just determined empirically in the lab. Okay, so one comment I want to make, right, is melting curves can be very different. So if you see someone using this, you probably want to check what the melting curve is. Like if we were to look at Zurn Bohler's melting curve for NGO here, you can see it's pretty different by, 1,500 degrees here at 40 GPA from these simulations and some other experimental work. So this can have a big effect on this. And also, if you're looking at multiple phases, right? So if you're looking at, say, bridgmanite and ferropericlase and they have very different melting curves, at a given mantle temperature, they're going to have different behavior because one might behave like a high temperature style of deformation. Another one might behave like something relatively cold.
Lowell, sorry, another question.
Yeah.
So I remember being a graduate student with two postdocs in the kind of group, and one liked to use the homologous temperature scaling,
uh-huh.
and the other one would tell me that it was complete nonsense and you can only use it on metals. Can you give us some insight on when it's appropriate?
No, I don't actually have any insight on that.
Okay.
Maybe someone else can comment. But yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty widely used. I don't know what his argument is on that. Could be right. Do you have a good comment on this?
So it works beautifully for metals, and empirically for rocks, the idea that a homologous temperature gives you the rheological transitions is shown with lab data. However, the strict idea of a single melting temperature doesn't exist for rocks. And so that's where you should have great caution about this concept. But for a simple metal, it's gorgeous.
So is your two-phase loop, essentially, is part of the problem.
In Poirier's book, he has a nice book about it. And there is one chapter talking about is homologous temperature scaling. And it seems like for metal, it works pretty well. And for argon halide, it works well as well. And for some oxides, it also works. But for a complicated structure, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, I think that's pretty typical for most rheological. And you'll see a lot of the things for like dislocations to work really well for ionics and metals. But when you start putting covalent and mixed bonding in, then right, things get a little dicey. So, yeah, you should talk to other people, Fed. That'll teach you to ask me questions. Okay, so where I wanted to go with this is I wanted to talk about how can you deform something through diffusion, okay? And so essentially when we're talking about diffusion creep, what we're doing is we're applying a stress, and the stress is what's driving the movement of atoms and vacancies. So if you have a compressive stress and a tensile stress this way, you move vacancies towards the compressive stress and atoms away from it towards the tensile stress. And if you do this with enough atoms, you can change the shape of your grain. I'm going to show you in a second that what you end up with is a Newtonian or linear rheology where your strain rate is related directly to your stress. Okay. There's two kinds of this, Nabarro-Herring creep, which is through the crystal, and then you can also do it along grain boundaries. So it's just a matter of path difference, and they look a little bit different, okay? Obviously, you know, since we've looked at diffusion, we can pretty much figure out this is going to depend on the diffusion coefficient. So the diffusion coefficient's large, it's going to be more efficient, and it's got to deal with the length scale. So if you have really big grains, it's really hard to move material from one side to the other. Okay, so it tends to be good at small grain sizes, okay, and it's good at high temperature. Okay, so the the way you look at this is you just rewrite your Fick's law, basically, in terms of vacancies. So if you have your crystal and it has some equilibrium vacancy concentration, and you have some vacancies at the compression side and vacancies at the tension side, your flux looks something like that. Alpha is just a geometric factor. That's actually what gets changed between those two types of diffusion creep. Okay, so all you're going to do then is you're going to write you're going to try and formulate a strain, right? So you've got some change in H, which is a grain size, with time, and it looks like something times the vacancies per second and then atomic volume over grain size squared, and then you just take a time derivative essentially and put it into strain rate, and you get something that looks like this. And then your vacancy concentration is going to have an Arrhenius relationship, as does your diffusion coefficient. So you get something with an RT in the bottom. This is a differential stress. Okay, you end up with a function like this. And the important points I want to make about this, I don't need you to follow this too much, except that your diffusion coefficient matters a lot, right? If your diffusion is efficient, it works really well. If it's not, it doesn't, okay? And because you have this temperature dependence, and we saw that D has this exponential relationship to temperature, the temperature is really important. The other thing that's really important here is that you have a grain size in the bottom here. So as grain size goes up, right, this goes down by the inverse of that with the square, okay? So grain size is really important. This isn't going to work at large grain sizes. And then again, just to hammer this point home, right, you have your sigma is just linearly proportional to strain rate. Okay, alpha changes depending on if you allow grains to slide or not. Okay, but that's not really the most important thing here. Okay, cobble creep. This is where you allow it to diffuse around the boundaries. And you end up with something that looks pretty similar, except, let's see, you have a grain size to the cube in the bottom. So there's a different grain size sensitivity. You also have something about the thickness of the grain boundary, because you have to diffuse through the grain boundary. And now your diffusion coefficient's related to the grain boundary diffusion instead of the volume diffusion. But it basically looks the same with a few sort of geometric factors that are different. Okay. And I want to make a point here is that these two types of diffusion are really happening in tandem. You don't really have a situation where you have one or the other happening at one time. These are just kind of in-member models. Okay, so diffusion is one way we can do this. Another way we can do this is by propagating dislocation, which is a line defect through the crystal. Okay, and if we look historically, the way people thought you could accomplish ductal deformation was to take a row of atoms and just shift them over, right? And you can calculate, Frenkel did this in 1926, what the shear strength of a set of atoms is if you just move them past each other. And you come up with a function like this, your maximum shear strength is basically your shear modulus times your two atomic spacings, right? B over A, so it's like a shear, sort of like a shear strain. And so this is all derived from metals. And in a metal, if you have a monoatomic lattice, your A and B are basically the same. So you can call that about 1. And you find out that it should be something like shear modulus over 2 pi. Okay. Now, if you start looking at the typical range of shear moduli for metals, you find they're sort of like 20 to 150 GPa. So you expect your shear strength to be sort of 3 to 30 GPa. And if you actually deform a metal, you find it's like 0.5 to 10 MPa, so a couple orders of magnitude different. Right? So why is that? And there's sort of three landmark papers, Taylor, Orwan, Polanyi in 1934. And so this is Taylor's model. And what the idea is that as you apply a shear to a crystal, instead of shearing the whole plane at once, what you're doing is you're breaking one bond at a time and allowing this to propagate through your crystal, and so you can deform your crystal at much lower stresses than the ideal shear strength. Okay, so this is just a little animation. You have an extra half plane of atoms here, and you can see the bond sort of ticking through. Some terminology, this thing called the Burgers vector is basically the length of motion of the dislocation at each step, and then you have this line defect here where you've got this extra half plane of atoms. Taylor was remarkably basically on point with how he envisioned this. It turns out you can see these if you look in a transmission electron microscope. So this is an dolomite single crystal. All these little lines here and squiggles, these are actually the defect in the structure that you can see. Okay, so that animation I showed you is something called a line or an edge dislocation. So it's a line defect propagating where your defect is this way and it's moving along. You can also have a dislocation where the displacement is along the line defect, and we call this a screw dislocation. And so if you look at your lattice, it kind of looks like this. You'll get like a corkscrew, right? And the reason they're called screw dislocations is if you look at TEM images, they look like these little coils going through your crystal, okay? And of course, like all things in life, these are end members, and really what you typically have is a mixed dislocation. So you get something where your dislocation kinks, and so you have a portion that's screw character, and like if we look over here, so you got a screw dislocation here and an edge dislocation here, okay? So nothing's ever easy. Okay, so if we wanna look just at what it takes to move a dislocation, we have something called the pyrrole stress or lattice friction. It's kind of a funny story. Pyrrole actually didn't care about dislocations at all. He was working on the Manhattan Project, but he was hanging out with Orwan, and Orwan had some equations he couldn't solve, and so Pyrrole did it in a couple hours. But he was a little bit hurried, and he made an algebraic error. He had an extra factor of 2 in the exponent, which actually makes a big difference, right? And then this was later corrected by Nabarro of Nabarro-Herring diffusion creep, 1947, and so he gets to have his name in this model for fixing the 2. He actually did some other things with it, but so in any case, when you go through this, it basically looks you have your pyrrole stress, which is basically just a stress to move this dislocation without any thermal activation. Okay, so it's a cold process. And you've got your shear modulus here that it's directly proportional to. You've got something that is a correction for the dislocation character, whether it's a screw dislocation or an edge dislocation. And then you have this here, which you know has some number here, and then your lattice spacing, so how far apart your planes are, divided by the distance the dislocation has to move. Okay, so a couple of things here. If you have something that's very, very stiff, right, like diamond, it's basically controlled by the shear modulus. Okay, and in general, when you look at this, you can see that plasticity sort of to a first order follows elastic properties. So if you have something that's very stiff, has a very high shear modulus, very very stiff elastic properties, it tends to be pretty strong plastically too. At least for lattice friction. Okay. The other thing that's important here is as the spacing of your lattice planes gets further apart, right, and you can think about distance being sort of weaker bonds. If your bonds are longer, right, it's easier to break those bonds, it's easier to move it, right? And then the shorter the distance you have to move it, the easier it is to move. Okay, and so that's this thing here. And frequently people will try and sort of predict what slip system should be active in a material based on the what's the widest spacing and what's the shortest Burger vector. Okay. Now, as we talked about for homologous temperature, this works really well for metals, but once you start to have minerals where you have different types of bonds, more than one type of atom, this is actually derived from a monatomic crystal, right? Then things get more complicated, and this is not necessarily a good way to figure out what is the glide plane and glide direction. Okay. Yeah.
So in the diagram that you showed before, the Burgersley vector is very much related to the spacing between the atoms. So
not always, okay? Sometimes they go directly, and sometimes they split into partial dislocations.
But I guess what I'm wondering, DHKL is not any lattice spacing. It has to be in some kind of direction. So how is it not related to the Burgers vector, which means you're moving along?
In something that's all the same spacing, if your lattice is spaced equally in all directions, then yes, that direction can be the same. But you're not always gliding in a simple plane. Like if you're gliding perpendicular to C, right, and you're in a cubic mineral, then yes, those things might be the same. But if you're gliding in something like a 110 plane and you're not cubic, then your Burgers vector and your plane spacing can be different. right? Because you're not necessarily a cubic mineral where all things are the same in all directions.
I just don't know what HKL means.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, HKL is just the Miller index of the lattice plane. So, yeah. Okay. So dislocation glide and creep. Okay, this is the same animation, right? So glide is governed by this lattice friction, and it's going to glide on a plane in the crystal that's given by these Miller indices and in a direction, right? We need to define the plane and the direction that it's moving. Okay. Dislocation creep, which is what we're going to encounter in the Earth, is really a combination of glide and a diffusion process. Okay, so you can propagate your dislocation in this plane and in this direction, but you can also allow diffusion to have it climb out of this plane. Okay, and I'll talk about why that's useful in just a second. Okay, the sort of big picture thing here is this gives a nonlinear behavior. So your strain rate ends up proportional to stress raised to an exponent, and typically for silicates and oxides, you're sort of in this 3 to 5 range. Metals can be much higher, like 20, even higher than 20. Some oxides are higher. So it's a material-dependent property. It also depends how much climb you have versus how much glide. Okay. Okay. So the way you get, if you want to formulate a constitutive law for dislocation glide, what you do is you recognize that you have some average strain in your crystal, which is related to the number of dislocations that are moving, and you tend to have multiple ones moving on parallel planes because you have lots of lattice planes in your crystal. You have basically a shear strain, so your Burgers vector over your D spacing. So this is your lattice spacing again. And that's if you look at that, that's just a shear strain. This would be a highly exaggerated portion of my crystal. And if you only have one part of your crystal slip because you're still propagating this dislocation, then you multiply it by your delta L over L. Okay. Then you can basically figure out how to put this in terms of a volume and define a dislocation density as your number of dislocations per volume, and you get your strain is equal to your Burger vector times your dislocation density and the amount that the crystal slipped, okay? And then you take a time derivative, and recognizing that you have velocity over here, you get this very famous equation called the Orrawan equation, which just says that your strain rate is equal to the dislocation density times the Burger's vector and the dislocation velocity, okay? So all flow laws involving dislocation glide start with this, okay? Or dislocation climb start with this equation, which is remarkably simple. Okay, so now what we're gonna do if we wanna figure out what something's gonna look like in the Earth is we wanna put in climb. And why do we care about climb? So if we propagate just a single dislocation in a crystal, it's happy, it's happy, it's happy, it goes along. But actually what happens, and I'll show you why a little bit later, you always have multiple dislocations moving, you always have multiple slip systems active. And if you have a dislocation coming and interacting with another dislocation, they stop each other. You get something called pinning. So if you're like rolling your rug along and someone comes and rolls another roll in there, then it gets harder for you to roll your little roll along and you get work hardening, okay? So you can see this if you take a paper clip and you bend it a bunch of times, you've probably all done this and eventually it breaks. What you're actually doing is when you bend it, you're inducing dislocations. And as you bend it more and more, those dislocations start to tangle, it hardens and it eventually turns brittle. Okay, so this is a picture of a dislocation around a tangle around a precipitate. So it pinned here, and then all these dislocations built up and interacted with each other, and you actually get a stress crack that can form. So this is the problem in like metals when you're trying to engineer a material. If you have little precipitates, you get corrosion cracking. Okay, so what we want to do then is we want to have this extra degree of freedom where we can allow our dislocation to climb up and go over these other dislocations so that we can keep deforming things. So this is something called recovery, okay? So basically, high temperature allows our dislocations to move around that, and what we're doing is we're just moving vacancies around. So again, you have to have vacancies because it's a diffusion process. And the way you put this into the Orrawan equation is you just rewrite your velocity in terms of like a time, so it's a distance over some time, right? And you just have your time to glide versus time to climb. Now, if climb is a slow process, right? If glide is more efficient, climb is slow, and so you just recognize that your time to climb is larger than your time to glide, so it's sort of approximately delta L over the time to climb, Okay, and then you can put that into your Orwan equation. And that's sort of a Orwan equation for Klein. Okay. Okay, so if you want to get this to a flow law where you have a strain rate related to stress somehow, you have to figure out a way to treat dislocations sources. And probably the one that most people reference is this one by Wertmann. There's other models. They're all sort of based on the same approach. And this is going to show us the behavior we care about. So all he did was he treated his dislocations as loops that propagate outward and said, OK, well, if we have two loops and there's some spacing d apart, these two dislocations can migrate into each other. So my half planes can come together and they can form a whole plane. We get rid of the dislocation. And that way, we can say, OK, we have a balance of dislocation formation and then annihilation of dislocations. And then we can reach a steady state, right? So we can get a steady state behavior where we have a constant dislocation density, okay? And there is some good reason to think that dislocation should propagate as loops. We have something called a Frank-Reed source that we observe. So if you have a dislocation line, it tends to bow out, and then it'll kind of come around and bow, and it'll make a loop come back and meet itself, and then those loops will propagate out. So this is a TEM image of a dislocation loop in silicon. Okay, and you can see it makes these nice circular sources, okay? So this is basically assuming that you have a steady state of dislocation formation and recovery, okay? So you just basically say, well, I have a circular dislocation. I've got a density of dislocation sources that looks like this. And if I assume that this is balanced by recovery, then I get a nice simple expression for density, and you just put this into the Orwan equation, okay? I've obviously skipped a lot of steps. And then you have to figure out what your Klein velocity is, and you know it's proportional to a diffusion coefficient times stress. I didn't put an exact one in there. And you know your stress is basically a shear strain times a shear modulus. And if you put that in, you get this. This is the flow law assuming Wertmann's model. Okay. So the things that are important in this is that you now don't have a Newtonian rheology. Okay, you now have a power law behavior, and if you assume that you're Klein controlled, you assume these circular sources, you get a 4.5 stress exponent. Okay. The other thing to note, there's no grain size dependence for dislocation glide. Okay, it doesn't care what your grain size is at all. And the point I want to make for if you're trying to figure out what a viscosity is for the mantle, there isn't a single viscosity, right? Because your viscosity depends on your stress levels or your strain rate, okay? And so depending on what your stress or strain is, you have a different viscosity. So you're kind of stuck making like an effective viscosity or figuring out a way to deal with a stress exponent, okay? Okay, now typically people write this in a different way. They kind of combine these flow laws so you can just deal with one, and you've got a strain rate where you've got your stress with a stress exponent, and then you've got your grain size here with sort of a grain size exponent. Okay, and that's kind of the way they deal with it. You have your Arrhenius relationship here that's got your activation energy and your PEV to deal with your vacancy concentration. Okay, so you know you'll see people say, well, okay, diffusion creep is when I have n equals 1, so that makes this Newtonian, and I have a grain size sensitivity of 2.5. Yeah.
Arrhenius relationship, because you've described that that's the thing that relates to diffusion, but we've got a bunch of different diffusion processes here. And to what extent do we think that we can capture that with just one of these laws?
Oh, okay, so I should say this is really, this formulation is really semi-empirical, right? I think, depending on, if you talk to Patrick Cordier, he'll say there's no theory to this at all, right? This is just something we made up and it fits.
Maybe to ask it differently, that the various diffusive processes that we've been talking about, how similar or dissimilar are those in terms of their rates?
You're talking like Klein versus diffusion.
Well, because Klein is a rate-limiting process. Diffusion creep is sort of a diffusive process. So
yeah,
it's in both the rheological laws, but the question is it similar?
I think the idea is, right, it's all related to this to a diffusion coefficient. So yes, it's the same. That's the assumption you make. Now, I'm not sure that's true because first of all, the diffusion coefficient is not isotropic. So if you're diffusing one way versus another, and you can think if you're climbing, you know, if you're trying to shear a crystal this way, you're climbing this way, your diffusion coefficient is probably different than if you're diffusing this way. So I don't know. I don't want to commit on that. I mean, I don't think it is the same, but this seems to fit data pretty well. Now, what I'm going to show in a second is actually when you look at what these values are and what the ranges that you measure, there's huge, huge errors. So it could be partly that, but this is not actually as precise as you might like to believe. So yeah.
This is actually my next question. It's E plus PB.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
You're right.
My next one.
Okay. I thought you said it's my next question. Okay, good. Good work. So, like, most of the time people say this grain size exponent's 2.5, and if you remember, right, our volume diffusion was a 2, and our cobble, our grain boundary was a 3, so that's basically saying, well, it's somewhere in between there. Same thing with dislocation creep. People typically say 3 to 5, and there's no grain size sensitivity. One point I want to make, right, these are competing processes, okay? So you don't just have one or the other, and so saying, well, there's no grain size sensitivity, it depends where you are, right? It depends what's dominating. And if you think about sort of which one's dominating, right, you have something where you have a strain rate with a stress to an exponent versus a linear Newtonian rheology. Well, okay, if your stresses are small, if you look at this, right, if this is small and you put it to an exponent, it becomes very, very small. So at small, small stresses, this actually gets inefficient, And this tends to take over. Okay, so you can think about it as which process of these two is a more efficient way to change the shape of your grains. Okay, and so you can also see here, right, if you think about your diffusion length scale, it's basically increases as a square here, and so if you your time scale is going to get large if you have big grains, and so it just doesn't work very well. Okay, and then again, temperature is high, then your diffusion is going to become more efficient, right? So, since I'm not a geodynamicist, I can't make pretty pictures of mantle convection, so I just use the USGS's picture here from one of their very introductory slides. But I just wanted to make a quick point, like where do you expect dislocation creep versus diffusion creep? Well, if you've got material circulating, right, you've got cold material coming down, at the edges here you've got lots of strain, right? So you expect high strain rates, high stresses, because it's both cold and you're straining fast, so you're probably gonna have some dislocation creep over here. Whereas if you're in the middle of these convection cores, you don't have as much strain, right? And so if your strain's low, your strain rate's low, then you probably are going to have more diffusion creep in the middle, okay? And I think, you know, if you start getting over here where you maybe have hot upwellings, then I'm not so sure which one you have, right? Because your strain rates might be high, but you might also have really hot material. So you kind of have to figure out where you are. And I'll go into that a little bit more in a minute, but just to keep that in mind. Okay, so I wanted to just show, this is from King 2017, and this is for olivine dislocation creep, and this is sort of taking, well, what are the sort of errors in these different parameters in the flow law, and how much does it affect the viscosity you get out? Okay, so you put in some different geotherms. This is just for the upper mantle. And the reason I show this is because olivine is the one that we actually can measure flow laws on and pretty well. Okay, and when you go deeper in the mantle, you don't actually really get flow laws. Okay, if you start changing activation energy within the range of what people measure, you see you're getting like close to two orders of magnitude different in viscosity. If you change activation volume, it's pretty scary because it doesn't even change the same with depth, and you get very, very large differences. And the same thing with grain size, right? If you don't know your grain size, then you've got pretty big uncertainties in here. So I just wanted to make the point that even if we measure these flow laws, what it actually means for the Earth has a pretty wide range of acceptable values, okay? Okay, so the way we typically start looking at these and trying to figure out what's happening in the Earth is you look at, okay, well, we can take material properties and fit flow law data to it, and we can say, okay, the mechanism that yields the fastest strain rate is the one that's going to dominate, and we'll just put some lines in some kind of space. So this is homologous temperature versus normalized shear stress for a specific grain size and temperature, and you say, okay, well, you know, here we've got diffusion creep, up here we just have glide, so this is what they call plasticity in this one. Power law creep is diffusion creep, and then you have dislocation creep up here. And you say, okay, well, these boundaries are laid out where these two mechanisms have equal rates, okay? And so I think one thing to caution, if you look at this and you're trying to decide what thing's active, if you're right here, they both are, right? It's not a sharp transition, okay? And you can do this for different grain sizes. So now we're looking at some maps for olivine. These are now quite old, but sort of a classic text on this. And if you have 10 micron versus 1 millimeter, what you see is that the area of power law creep or the area of dislocation creep has gotten bigger because diffusional flow is now inefficient, okay? And you can do things like you can contour for strain rates, and you can follow a strain rate contour, and you can say, well, you know, here's where I should be in the earth, okay? So I'm now down here, or I'm now down here, okay? I'm going to show this again, but here's where we have experiments, okay? It's up here. And if you're looking at what's happening in the earth, you're along this, actually maybe even slower strain rates than this, okay? So one of the major issues with rheological studies is we can never make a geologic strain rate experiment. Grad students don't stick around that long, right? Okay, so I want to, how much time do I have? Okay, I'm good. Okay, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about one particular aspect before we move on of dislocations, is that they will typically cause preferred orientation, and I know Maureen talked a little bit about this. And so I use the term texture, which if you came from a geology background, it's kind of confusing because geologists have taken texture to mean microstructure. I'm using it to mean crystallographic preferred orientation. And so what happens is as you deform crystals, because they glide on specific planes and specific directions, you get predictable rotations, okay? And so you start to get all your grains oriented in one type of direction. And I think this is kind of a cool photo. This is an ice core from a glacier. And this is at the top, and what we're looking at is a cross-polarized light. So you have a section where you bring polarized light in and you put a cross-polarizer, and because the crystals twist your polarized light more or less, it's just shear wave splitting for seismologists. You get different colors if it's a different orientation. Okay, that's just the punchline, right? So at the top of the glacier sheet, you see you get lots of different colors, so things are more randomly oriented, right? This grain has a different orientation than that grain. But if you go 100 meters down, you've now compacted this, you've deformed these ice crystals by dislocation glide, you now see that they all have more or less the same color, telling you that they're in the same, more or less same orientation, okay? So now at the bottom, towards the bottom of the glacier, you have preferred orientation, okay? So going back in history a bit, how do we think about slip systems and how they're active and how this generates preferred orientation? We can go back to 20s and 30s. Schmid did some really classic work on single crystals of metal. So this is a zinc single crystal that's been pulled. And what you see, these are actually the slip bands from dislocations along the length of this crystal. And what he did is he plotted basically the stress needed to make this deform relative to the orientation of the, so if you pull it and you change the orientation between your slip system and the tensile direction, you get a plot like this, and it fits this nice cosine function. So the idea is you have this resolved shear stress, right? You're resolving it onto the slip plane and slip direction, and then this is the stress there, okay, that you apply. And the Schmid factor tells us basically if you're going to activate a slip system or not. And you can imagine, right, if you've got your slip system perpendicular to your tension, nothing happens, right? You can't pull it apart. And so your best case scenario is when your slip plane and slip direction are 45 degrees from your maximum stress, okay? And so you get glide when your resolved shear stress exceeds some critical resolved shear stress. So it's basically this elastic plastic model I introduced at the beginning, okay? So how does this work to generate texture? Well, we can start in a real simplistic way by thinking of a single crystal. So if you have a deformation piston in a single crystal and it glides specifically on this plane in some direction, what happens is your crystal actually changes shape, okay? But the lattice of the crystal isn't rotating yet. What causes it to rotate is it has to stay stuck to these pistons, and it causes it to rotate sort of back the backward sense, I guess, okay? You can also do it with twinning. I'm not going to talk about twinning here. But basically, you're dealing with a specific plane in a specific direction, and it's this compatibility maintaining contact that makes the rotation occur, okay? If we look at a polycrystal, it's quite a bit more complicated. Now it's your neighboring grains that are causing the rotation, right? And without going too deep into this, there's just kind of two end members that people use to deal with this. One is to assume that the strain is homogeneous from grain to grain, and another one's to assume that the stress is homogeneous, okay? So this one's sort of the easiest one conceptually, right, where you just squeeze everything and they all squish the same, okay? Now the problem with this is if you have a grain where your slip plane is unfavorably oriented, it shouldn't really deform, right? It should transfer stress to the neighboring grains and they should deform more. And so what ends up happening here is if you calculate the stresses for this crystal, they tend to be too, or for this polycrystal, they tend to be too high, unrealistically high, okay? Because you're forcing things to deform that shouldn't deform, okay? It works in specific cases. There are some minerals that have lots of slip systems available, particularly high symmetry materials. And if you have five slip systems, that gives you enough freedom to deform into an arbitrary volume. And so the Taylor model works pretty well, okay? The other end member is to assume your stresses are the same. So if you have a grain like this one, right, this slip plane is oriented to this stress in a way where it can't deform on that. Well, if you assume stresses are all the same, this one doesn't do anything. That's fine. This one deforms a lot, right? But the issue here is you start opening gaps and overlaps, right? So it's a non-physical model, okay? This actually predicts pretty well some minerals like olivine, which doesn't have very many slip systems. But reality is somewhere between these two. And so when we actually do modeling, we do something in between. But these are kind of the two end member ways you can think of how a crystal deforms. Okay, so why do we care about texture? And I think I probably don't have to do too much on this because I know Maureen talked about olivine. Basically, in the 60s, people noticed that seismic waves are anisotropic in the shallow upper mantle. P waves travel faster in some directions than other directions. And Hess figured out that this was probably due to preferred orientation of olivine. Okay. Later deformation experiments established that olivine slips on actually quite a few slip planes, but in a particular slip direction most of the time. Okay, and then Francis said, well, okay, if it's going to slip in this A direction here, which is this direction in the crystal, that's going to align with the flow direction. And if we look at the velocity surface of an olivine crystal, we see that the A direction is fast. So that means the fast P wave propagation is the flow direction. Okay, and that's sort of the quick and dirty way of interpreting mantle anisotropy. I want to make a caution on this. Okay, slip directions don't always align with the flow direction, and slip planes don't always align in the shear plane. Most of the time, they actually don't. It works pretty well for olivine, and again, that relates sort of to those two end members of plasticity. In general, it's very, very difficult to only activate one slip system. Okay, and so if you think about something like this, where you take a set of grains and you squish them, right, you can activate, say, slip system one to shear this into a parallelogram, but then you have to activate a second slip system to make it the right shape to fit back in. Okay, and because of these geometric constraints, you typically end up activating multiple slip systems when you deform something in dislocation, glide, or creep. Okay, and so this is an additional complexity. I'm just going to quickly show these. I don't actually show that many textures in this, but I know that you'll see them. You're going to encounter them, so I thought I'd explain what they are. So essentially, when you're looking at a texture, they're generally plotted in something called a pole figure. And so what you're doing is you're taking a specific crystallographic plane and you're projecting it into the upper hemisphere. Okay, so it's like you're just looking at the intersection of axes with an equal area hemisphere. And then if we were to look down at the top, like these crystals are all oriented so that this plane is pointing up, we get a clustering in the middle, and these bright colors equal more orientations, and the blue ones equal fewer orientations. if you're looking at experiments, you might actually see something that's called an inverse pole figure, and instead of looking at one specific direction in the crystal, you're actually looking at one sample direction. So for example, these are all compression inverse pole figures, and what they're showing is the normal to the plane and how it orients relative to compression. So in this one, we have like a hot color here at the 001, so that's telling us this plane perpendicular to the crystal C-axis is aligning in compression. Okay, and you can see like this one starts out with 100 in compression, and then it's shifting and developing a 001 maximum. Now, these are actually full spheres, but because there's symmetry to minerals, you can truncate different regions and you can show smaller areas. And so you'll see like funny shapes depending on the symmetry of the material, but all you really care about is what these little indices are and where your hot color is, okay? So this is just my cautionary tale, right, on interpretation of textures. If you say, well, I'm going to align my slip plane in the maximum in the shear plane and my slip direction in the shear direction. Sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't. If we take a really simple case, this is compression of ferropericlase, and it slips on 110. So you've got your 110 plane here, you 001, 111, and as you compress it, actually 001 aligns perpendicular to compression. So the rotation is not what you expect. And if you shear something, so this is a halite experiment where it's deforming on the same slip system, these two minerals are isostructural, you actually don't ever see 110, the shear plane now is horizontal, you don't ever see 110 align in the shear plane. Okay. So anytime you have multiple slip systems, and part of the reason is that these have symmetrically equivalent slip systems, so lots of them are active, you don't get that behavior. Okay. So I just want to say be careful about using that sort of interpretation because it's frequently not true. The other issue with shearing is an unstable geometry for texture development. And you can see that even by 50% shear strain, which would be a huge shear strain for an experiment, at high pressure, this is an ambient condition experiment, you have not developed a fabric that persists. And in fact, what you see as you go to higher and higher shear strains is that different patterns form, they coalesce and they come apart and they recoalesce. Okay, so you don't get a pattern that just stays throughout your deformation. So you have to know something.
So in the ferropericlase example, could that be taken as evidence of the dominant slip system changing at high pressure to 001 rather than 110?
No, because when you have 111 or 110 slip, you have two planes like this, and these two cancel each other's rotation. And so as the grain comes, if you squish it, it rotates this way, and this is your 100 direction. And so it actually conceptually makes sense when you think about what's happening, because in this case, because the slip itself isn't causing the rotation, it's actually you're forming a flattened grain, and it's flattened perpendicular to 001. That's where you get that rotation. This is something that you can simulate really well with a plastic, polycrystal plasticity code. Yeah.
Generalize that the lower symmetry structures wouldn't have this issue much?
Lower symmetry is better, but like in post-perovskite, if you have 001 slip plane, it tends to rotate 001 in compression. So like this previous texture, this one I showed you. So if you model this, 001 will give you this, right? But so will 011. Okay, and it all depends on if there's more than one of them and what the axial ratios are and how these all interact. Okay, so it is a little bit, if it's orthorhombic and it's a simple plane, so it only has one index and there's no symmetric variance, yes, it will work if you only activate that slip system. So there are cases where it works. Olivine, it works pretty well. Okay, so I thought I'd sort of settle this down a little bit and just kind of show some nice pictures for a second before I get back to some implications. And also I wanted to explain what are the limitations and how we measure this and what can we do and what can't we do, okay? So I like showing this picture of sort of what do we want to do to study these materials, right? We really want to do controlled rheology experiments all the way down to PT conditions of the core mantle boundary. We want to be able to control composition And Mynak's going to talk later about volatiles. I'm not going to talk about volatiles because I don't know how to control them at very high pressure. So we'd like to be able to control things like oxygen fugacity, et cetera, et cetera. And we want to be able to change stress and strain rates. You know, ideally, we'd like to do a geologic strain rate. So something like this, this is this big press at the University of Bayreuth. I call it Big Orange. It's probably got some real name. So something like this that goes to 130 GPA, 3,000 Kelvin, right? This is my fantasy. And we can't do that, okay? So we have a couple things. We have something that I'll call a controlled rheology device, so like a rotational Drickamer, the deformation Dia, DT cup. So these do large samples. So we're talking like a millimeter, maybe 2 millimeters. Okay, so these are huge. And you can do strain rates sort of down to like 10 to the minus 5, okay? You have pretty good control of sample environment, but you're kind of limited to transition zone, and if you're super heroic, you can get to the top of the lower mantle, okay? On the other hand, we have the diamond anvil cell. This is not a great device for deformation, but it gives you pressure, okay? And that's something you can't get over here. It's really poorly constrained strain and strain rates. Our samples are very small. It's very hard to measure the strain, thus we can't get strain rate. But you can do some sort of back of the envelope calculation of this, maybe 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. But typically the way we do these is we squeeze, we collect data, we squeeze, we collect data. So it's a discontinuous strain rate. So you don't really know your strain rates, so you can't really construct a flow law, right? Because if you want to construct a flow law, you need a steady state controlled strain rate, okay? Samples are tiny. It's pretty hard to control sample environment in these types of experiments. You can go to very high pressures at ambient temperature, and you can do some high temperature experiments. It's actually fairly tricky to do deformation at high temperature, and that's been sort of a technical challenge. Okay, so the way these work, this is the so-called deformation Dia. I've heard multiple names about why it's called Dia. This is actually not an acronym. Some people say it's because you compress diagonally. Other people say it was originally used to make diamonds, so Dia comes from diamond. In any case, Dia is the name. It's not an acronym. D stands for deformation, though. So it's a one-letter acronym. And the way it works, right, is you take six anvils, so you've got four on the sides, two on top, you can squeeze everything together to make a hydrostatic compression, and then you can cycle the top in and out. And what's cool about it is you can bring x-rays in, you can take x-ray diffraction, and I won't go into the details of how you do this, but you can figure out the stress in your sample, you can measure preferred orientation development, or you can take a radiography image, so like the same way if you break your wrist, right, you go and you get a radiography image, and you can image what's happening to the sample. Well, it's at PT conditions, okay? And so that's really cool because it lets you measure strain and strain rate. Okay, so this is a sample in the D-Dia at the start of an experiment. This is the top of the sample, that's the bottom, and then after 30% strain, it's shorter and fatter, right? Pretty exciting. You can also do something with the rotational Drickamer. Drickamer is a person who made a non-rotating one, and if you put rotation, you call it a rotational Drickamer. And so this one is an opposed anvil geometry. So you have two anvils. You have basically a confining ring with a gasket assembly, and you can bring things together. You can squash them, get to pressure. You can heat them, and then you can twist an anvil, and that allows you to induce shear strain. Okay. Nice thing about this is you can get to very high strains with shear. Okay. And what you can do, right, is you can say, oh, I'm going to plot strain versus time. I'll fit some strain rates, right? I can figure out what my strain rates are. I can plot stress versus strain. And so here is where you jump your strain rate. There's something really weird happening out here. But the idea is, okay, you've got like your stress at some given strain rate, and then you've got a new stress at a higher strain rate. You plot that on a log-log plot. You fit a straight line, and you say, ah, my stress exponent's 3, okay? Great thing about log-log plots is almost everything looks like a straight line, as long as you're not really far out, right? So that's how you get a stress exponent. If you do the diamond anvil cell, you can't do anything like that because you don't really know what your strain rate is, okay? And here what you're doing is you're taking two gym quality diamonds, you're squeezing them together with a small sample in between, so this is like a 50 micron sample, and you can get really high pressure, but you can't really measure strain. High temperature experiments are really, really tough. Okay, there's a couple ways you do this. You can do this with laser heating, or if you want a more homogeneous temperature, you do resistive heating. So what we've done here is we've basically wrapped the diamonds in a piece of graphite, and if you pump sort of an obscene amount of current around it, or through it, it's like a glorified toaster oven, right? And it gets really hot. And then you put it in a vacuum because you can actually burn diamonds. Okay. Now, another way you can do this, and I am really not an expert on this, is there are ways to do this theoretically. So this is Patrick Cordier's group is really one of the leaders in this. And what they're doing, so this is bridgmanite with only a few atoms shown. And what they're doing is they're putting a dislocation kink in here, actually two of them, and then they're looking at how they move through the crystal. And please don't ask me about the details of how this works. But the idea is that if you do this, you can figure out what the critical resolved shear stress for different slip systems on different minerals. And what's nice is if you think you know what you're doing at sort of lab strain rates, you can actually extend these out to mantle strain rates. And then you can maybe say something. Okay. I want to reemphasize this, which is, where are we in the lab versus where we are in nature? Okay, so you construct a deformation map, right? You have stress, you have grain size. This is in a little bit different formulation than the last ones I showed you. This is at some pressure of 7 GPa, 1700 K. And our lab strain rates are somewhere up in here at this intersection between this low temperature plasticity, right, dislocation creep and diffusion creep, okay? And then you look at this flow map with data that you've compiled from lab strain rates, right? And you fit to these sort of semi-empirical flow laws, and you come out here and you say, well, we're here in the Earth, so this is where, these are our deformation mechanisms, okay? But you don't have any data in here, okay? And you don't actually know that there isn't some other mechanism that comes in here, right? Okay, and so if you look, this is again from Patrick Cordier's group where they propose, okay, you can have diffusion creep, you can have dislocation creep, or there's this new process that operates at mantle conditions and strain rates where it's just pure climb. You don't actually have the dislocations moving, you're just climbing these half planes, and you get some very different behavior, okay? That's a little unsettling, right? But it's sort of reality, okay? Okay, so then how do we figure out, right, what deformation mechanisms are operating in the Earth, right? Because I just sort of told you we don't know anything. Well, fortunately, in the upper mantle, we at least have hand samples, right? We can at least get rocks and look at them. And the way that people, this is sort of an oversimplification, but the way that people look at it is you get a peridotite, you look at it, and you say, okay, if it has preferred orientation, at some point, dislocation glide, maybe dislocation creep, because the glide component's what gives you the texture, that there was some kind of dislocation creep happening, okay? If you see evidence for strain, but you don't see any texture development, it's probably diffusion creep, okay? And that's how you make yourself feel a little bit more comfortable about this deformation mechanism extrapolation, okay? Now, there is something you have to be really careful about, because things that are brought to the surface have a really complicated deformation history. They had to get from down there to up here, and something happened in between, right? And you have to figure out what that is, and then look and see, you know, okay, I think this really happened at depth, not on the way up, right? The other thing that's really helpful, right, is seismic observations. So if you see seismic anisotropy, it's probably due to crystal preferred orientation. There are other mechanisms that can generate it, but this is sort of, I think, the most widely accepted explanation. So if you see seismic anisotropy, you probably have dislocation creep occurring, right, because you've got to have a way to generate preferred orientation, okay? This is worse if you go to transition zone and lower mantle. We don't have samples for microstructures. We have some very tiny samples that come up. You can maybe do some chemical studies on them, but they're not big enough to show you rock fabrics, okay? So basically here we're just relying on seismic observations to figure out is it diffusion or is it dislocation, right? And so you have to kind of make a leap of faith here.
Lowell, yeah. Quick question back here. So
you're a problem.
No, I'm not a problem. The students should be asking questions. Yeah, I'm trying to keep up with it. Okay, so if you go back a slide,
Sure.
Let's imagine you have a rock that's in the kind of shallow asthenosphere. It gets a texture because you're in the right regime, so you have dislocation creep. And then you take that rock and you move it into a different region where you might have a lot of strain, but you're in diffusion creep. What happens to the anisotropy of that rock?
Okay, that's a really good question. And some people argue that you tend to not overprint texture very fast, okay? But, right, if you have grain boundary sliding, right, and diffusion creep, then you might expect that, yes, you do actually overprint textures eventually, right? And so that's sort of my point here, is you have this really complicated strain history. You don't quite know where it acquired this microstructure, okay? So experimentally, I don't think there's a clear answer on that. Phil Schemer and Lars Hansen have a paper, and they sort of argue both sides in the paper that diffusion creep is going to make things random, or that you have diffusion creep and things just keep going along and they maintain their texture, but they're now deforming in diffusion creep. And so I actually don't know the answer to that. But I think it probably depends very strongly on how much grain boundary sliding you have and what your grain shapes are. Right? If you have elongated grain shapes and they stay elongated, they're going to stay oriented relative to the flow field because you have this geometric factor.
So if we detect like substantial seismic anisotropy in the upper lower mantle, that could be due to just inheritance and have nothing to do
Absolutely.
With the operation of dislocation creep at those depths.
Yeah, it might be totally inherited and it might have come from somewhere else. That's very possible.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For that to work, you would have to maintain the LPO through the phase transitions.
Yes, and this, okay, so when I was talking, what I was saying to you is basically if you have olivine and you move it to another olivine,
yeah.
It's different, right, if you take it through a phase transformation. And this is actually, this is really important. If you go from like olivine or ringwoodite, sorry, to bridgenite and ferropericlase where you have a dissociative phase transformation, you actually tend to weaken your textures. Now, if you go from bridgmanite to post-perovskite, it actually turns out you carry over a strong texture because what you're doing is sort of reshuffling atoms, okay? And you tend to preserve orientations between the parent and daughter grain, okay? So you actually can transfer texture through a phase transformation that way, but it depends what the mechanism of the phase transformation is. And that's something that's actually maybe easier to document than in experiments than rheological properties. Actually, it is easier. but yeah, there are ways to carry it through. But then I don't know, you know, after you do that, are you in dislocation creep or diffusion creep? And then does that overprint it or not? So, you had a question?
My question is about this CPO as well. You just show a theoretical calculation. They found a new mechanism like the climb dominated. I just wonder, for that mechanism, do they argue that it can not generate any CPO?
I don't remember what they argue. Generally, the conventional wisdom on this is that climb doesn't generate CPO. Okay, but as it turns out, if you have a very anisotropic diffusion coefficient, you can generate CPO in diffusion creep. Generally, the wisdom is that you don't. There are ways that you can, but it's sort of more unusual. So.
Okay. And another question is like for diffusion creep, according to those paradigm, you shouldn't generate any CPO. But I remember there is a study from a Japanese group, and they argue that they can generate CPO using pure diffusion.
Yeah,
creep.
Actually, there's lots of papers. There's ones on crustal rocks too. Oh. You see it in feldspars. But I think the thing to remember, right, is again, these are competing processes, right? You don't have a sharp transition from one to another. And generally speaking, if you're close to diffusion creep, dislocation creep boundary, right, you have some dislocation. So that's one possibility of a way to generate it. Another way is that you end up with anisotropic grain shapes because you actually have an anisotropic diffusion coefficient. And then you get rotations because your grain shapes. Okay, so there's actually ways to do this. And there are lots of studies actually that show you can get this. So this is something to be a little bit cautious about, saying, well, I don't see seismic anisotropy, so it has to be diffusion creep, or I see seismic anisotropy, so it can't be diffusion creep, right? There's a sort of big, really those lines on those maps should be this big wide gray bar, but it doesn't look so nice then, right? So. Okay. So I thought I would just look really quickly at some experiments and how theory stacks up and sort of what are the stronger, what seems to be stronger, what seems to be weaker. And some of these are like pretty, especially as we go to higher pressures, we're not doing controlled strain rate experiments. So they're not steady state experiments, they're not controlled strain rates. So I want to caution you strongly about some of those. So this is a figure from Ritterbeck's 2016. So he calculated different dislocations in Wadsleyite and compared these to, these are actually, I think, all but one of these is RDA data. Some of these are DDIA. And he's comparing to a 10 to the minus 5 strain rate. And what you see is the experiments fall sort of somewhere pretty close to this dislocation here, okay? And then what you can do is you can extend this out to mantle strain rates and you hope that your scaling works, and this would be your transition zone. So now you're going from sort of CRSS, so critical resolved shear stress of the slip system, and GPA out to MPA, right, as you go to higher temperature and slower strain rates. So things get weaker as they're slower and hotter. That actually happens to me too. So ringwoodite, we now see, if we look at the scale bar, is stronger, according to this. So here's some data from Kavner. This is room temperature diamond cell data. Here's high temperature data for me, actually. And you see in this case, these seem to fall along this like lower curve, but actually they seem to do a pretty good job predicting deformation, the flow loss. One comment I'll make, in this study at least, we see this slip system active. We don't really see this activity. So one thing that used to bother me a lot about doing experiments on preferred orientation and comparing them to Cordier's group is we never seem to get the same answer. And I've just gotten comfortable with the fact that I don't know why that is. But that's basically it. But they seem to match these flow laws pretty well, okay? Now, if we look at bridgmanite, according to these calculations, bridgmanite's even stronger. We have pretty sparse data here. There's a couple room temperature experiments. I actually have some more that I didn't put on here. But you know, this is your room temperature data. Here's high temperature data from Girard et al. And it's sort of in the right range. Here they show Pericles is much weaker, and this seems to get accentuated as you go to higher pressure. So this is sort of mid-mantle depth, mid-mantle temperatures. Okay, and I need to finish up really soon, so I'm gonna skip some slides at the end. If we look at ferropericles, okay, this is a horribly busy plot. These are bridgmanite. This is ferropericles. Just quickly, we found in this that there's a pretty marked strength increase between about 20 and 60. So going to mid-mantle depths, things get much stronger. And then Deng and Lee measured some diffusion measured diffusion coefficients and corrected with a homologous temperature scaling, and they see sort of a viscosity hump at depth, which would correspond roughly to this. Okay, so I think if you see in room temperature deformation data, which is measuring dislocations, and you also see in diffusion that things should get strong, then you expect, yes, at high temperature things should get strong. If you just see it in room temperature data, it's not so clear that it applies at high temperature when you start having diffusion active. Okay, and then I'm going to finish here. I have a bunch more slides, but I'm just going to stop because I was slow getting through this. This is bridgmanite and post-perovskite data, and of course, almost all of this is diamond cell. And the motivation for looking at this is some low-pressure analog materials seem to indicate that post-perovskite is weaker than bridgmanite. So in calcium iridate and sodium cobalt fluorides systems, this seems to be the case. So here's diamond cell data. These red colors are actually high temperature. So this is Girard and the RDA. This is a stress relaxation. These are actually basically annealing experiments that I did. And so, you know, you've got a pretty strong trend here in room temperature data. And if you compare that to room temperature data of post-perovskite, you might think actually if you extrapolated this to higher pressures that yes, at least at low temperatures, bridgmanite is maybe stronger than post-perovskite, but that's something to look into. And if, you know, and this is really important, right? Because if the base of the lower mantle is much weaker, that's going to have a really important impact on how mantle convection works, because you're going to have a lot of shear localization there. Okay, and actually, I should have probably put ferropericles on there, but it's probably sort of similar to bridgmanite. Okay. Okay. So let me just skip through this. If you want to talk about polyphase deformation, which is a huge can of worms, I'm happy to do that. So I just wanted to sort of make some thoughts here. So high stress regions tend to give you dislocation creep. So colder, higher strain rates or higher stress. So you're probably like slabs, edges of convection cells. You expect to see seismic anisotropy, and you expect sort of a power law behavior, okay? If you go to low stress regions, like stagnant convection cores, maybe plumes where it's really hot, then you kind of expect diffusion creep. You expect it to be Newtonian, and you expect isotropy, okay? I didn't talk about this, so just ignore that. And I'll stop there.
Very informational. So I just wonder, maybe this question is toward the whole audience, and or especially for people who are doing geodynamic modeling. You talk about the dislocation creep, like a new Newtonian versus non-Newtonian reality, right? And one thing I observe in the geodynamic literature is that when people model, say, subduction, especially a very important process. So you know, if you want to publish a paper, a modeling paper, and people will at least, ask, like, do you use non-Newtonian reality? If you do not, why, right? That's like preferred, like non-Newtonian seems like preferred for subduction environment, same thing that you said here. But my observation is that the effective viscosity, so ultimately you present viscosity, right? The effective viscosity contrast, lateral viscosity contrast resulting from this reality, it varies from paper to paper. I mean, some people, they claim that you're the same reality, but the lateral viscosity varies like one order of magnitude, very small. So therefore, it's very easy to converge. I mean, it's a very cheap way of using that. But some people, I would say they're probably more honest. I mean, using the original formulation, they got like 6 or 7 orders of magnitude viscosity variation. And that's really, really challenging for the modeler to work. So I just wonder, from your point of view, what kind of knobs do you have you allow us to change? I mean, I think somebody's taking a parameter. So which is the appropriate way? You know?
I should not comment about geodynamic modeling at all. That's getting really dangerous.
It's an empirical formula, but what are the real number? What are the parameters you really send you know from the parameters?
Well, okay. So I think if you're going to do a power law rheology, you know, if you're between 3 and 5, it probably doesn't matter. There are some things that are higher and lower, but that's probably a pretty good number. Like, you know, and again, it depends. I think the problem here is your stress exponent changes depending on what the contribution of diffusion is to what the contribution of dislocations are. And the more dislocations, the higher your stress exponent, right? If you look at dislocation glide without climb, you can get things that have a stress exponent of 20, right? But if you get closer and closer to diffusion creep regime, you might have a stress exponent of 2. Right? So I don't know, because where are you with respect to that transition and when you're next to a slab? You know, to me it's like pick 3 or 5. From my perspective, either one of them is right. I know some people say, well, 5 is way too high, but do you really know that? So here's the other thing. If you look at things like ferropericlase or periclase, and you look at all the sort of ambient condition literature, periclase has a very high stress exponent, okay? Now, in the mantle, you've got periclase, you've got bridgmanite, you've got a bunch of other stuff, right? What's the stress exponent of that aggregate, okay? And one thing to think about, too, right, is if things have different melting temperatures, right, regardless of how precise the homologous scaling is, you might have one phase that deforms in diffusion creep and one that deforms in dislocation creep. And so what is the stress exponent? What controls the stress exponent in a multi-phase aggregate? And we don't know, okay, is the answer.
What I should say, this sounds like a great point of topic, and we're going to be talking about research projects on Tuesday afternoon again, sort of focus in on things that we've talked about a little bit already, to have an opportunity for the people that have arrived to contribute. So this is a really good place to sort of go, I think, part of that discussion. So let's break now. Let's try to get back at 10 to 11. Sorry for the short coffee break, but let's get back at 10 to 11. And also, Curtis, the senior participants, he has your meal tickets.